everyone. I'm Ashley Banfield, and this is Drop Dead Serious. And I wanted to do an episode to bring you up to speed, if you're not already, on what the prosecutors in California believe David, the singer, who spells his name D4VD, what they allege he did to his underage girlfriend, Celeste Rivas Hernandez. Because if you get your hands on this people's briefing, and I have to call it a people's briefing. It's not an affidavit. It's not a charging document. It's none of those things. It is a briefing paper that the DA in California has put together for the judge in advance of a preliminary hearing for David. And, you know, you already know he's David Anthony Burke, but he goes by David D4VD. So for purposes of this podcast, that's what I'm calling him. Anyway, finally we know the narrative. Finally we know what the police have and what they allege this guy did to this poor young girl, this child who was only 14 when she met her death and had her 15th birthday rotting in the front trunk of his Tesla. We've known all along that the body of a girlfriend of his, an underage girlfriend, was rotting in his Tesla, and he's running off and doing a start of a tour, or at least starting and then canceling it real quick. But we couldn't quite figure out back in September of 2025 why they weren't arresting him. It seemed kind of obvious to us. Tesla's 400 feet away from your front door of your house, and there's a dead girlfriend cut up inside that Tesla. How is this a hard case? Well, in some ways it isn't. It's just unbelievably obvious. And in some ways it might be. So what I wanted to do for you today is actually go through this. Specifics. What do they have? And then talk to somebody who knows a lot more about the business of prosecuting criminals than I do, especially in California, and that's Matt Murphy. He's been a regular guest of mine, and he's one of my favorites as well. So Matt is a former homicide prosecutor, and he was in Orange County, and he's literally written the book on murder. It's called The Book of Murder. So yeah, Matt knows a thing or two about why there may have been this long 7-month delay between finding Celeste's body in that tow yard, right, where the car had been towed, to putting David Anthony Burke in handcuffs. And he's got some really good information on that, and I wanted to share that with you. He's got a couple of new podcasts, too. He's doing a podcast with my friend Mark Garagos, and guess what? I'm going to talk to Mark Garagos about this case as well to see the other side of where David Anthony Burke, David the singer, may actually be able to fight this, and why this big, long pause in between finding Celeste's body and putting David in cuffs might actually mean trouble for the prosecution. I know it's hard to believe once I tell you what I'm about to tell you. But anyway, so stay tuned, because when you hear what Matt Murphy has to say, I mean, he's thrilled about this. He's loving every minute of all the legal machinations, all the behind the scenes, the strategy, the spider web weaving. It's really, really cool. Some of it's kind of dry and sort of, you know, legal procedure, but it makes sense when he explains it as to what their process really was in trying to snare David into their web and get an indictment that might actually stick, get a charge, get a conviction that might actually stick. So let me start here. It's laid out kind of as a storybook. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but it really is. They effectively say that Celeste was 14, because we know that when she was found, it was the day after her 15th birthday. And so, yeah, she'd been in that trunk much longer than one day. So she spent her birthday rotting in that trunk. It's very, very sad. And they basically say it was towed 3 days before they discovered her body, because it had been towed from a location 400 feet from David's home in the Hollywood Hills. And surveillance video, this memo says, and other evidence, which I can't wait to find out about, confirmed that the defendant, David, was the last person to drive that vehicle on July 29th, 2025. That's pretty impressive that they have that much information leading to David actually being the person behind the wheel. Okay, so We all know that the Tesla had been impounded, that there was a lot of smell coming from the vehicle. But when they opened it, a few more details about what they actually found in the impound lot. They found a black cadaver bag covered in insects. That breaks my heart. Inside the bag was a severely decomposed head and torso, right? First of all, my God, a cadaver bag. Who has cadaver bags other than the medical examiner? As it turns out, the allegation is David. You're going to find out why he actually would be in possession, allegedly, of a body bag. So they find this body bag, and it's got a head and a torso in it. But then a plastic garbage bag is beneath it, right? It's beneath the black body bag. And inside the garbage bags, right, plastic garbage bag, is the dismembered arms and legs belonging to that torso and head that was in the cadaver bag. Don't ask me why. I don't know why there's a body bag and a plastic garbage bag, but that's how the allegation is that he did it. But there's more. Listed in this description is that the victim's ring and pinky fingers, left hand, so your wedding finger and your pinky finger next to it, they're amputated. They're gone, these two fingers. Okay, I get it. Remember, we were told that Celeste had David tattooed on her ring finger. And so I guess you're just going to take both of them off because maybe it's easier than just getting one of those fingers off. So that's pretty compelling evidence. You wanted to get rid of the word David. Who are you then? Might you be David? That's the allegation. Okay, so then the positive identification is made on September the 16th. So 8 days later, they ID this poor young girl as Celeste Rivas Hernandez. So the allegations that they lay out are that, and this is fascinating, David and Celeste met when Celeste was 11, January 2022. If you do the math, David at that time would have been about 16 and already starting his, you know, internet music career. So 16, and he's meeting a girl who's 11. Nonetheless, this goes on to say the sexual relationship began in November of 2023. So at this point, she's a year and a half older. She's actually just turned 13. She had her birthday in September. So yeah, she's a freshly turned 13-year-old middle schooler. The defendant at this point is 18. So now we're getting into the territory that's breaking the law. So the sexual relationship, they say, she's 13, he's 18. She just turned. And 3 months later, her family reports her missing because apparently they say she's spending so much time up in the Hollywood Hills with this guy. They're pissed off about it, right? Understandably. Then, not long after that, this is all actually in the same timeline, right? So Feb 24, she runs away and it's 3 months after the sexual relationship allegedly begins. Feb 24 as well, parents are angry. They get her back home and they take away her telephone. They confiscate her phone. Feb 24, same month, law enforcement says that David surreptitiously got a burner phone for her and paid somebody $1,000 to give her that phone. Wow, that's a lot. That's pretty indicting. Paid somebody in her hometown where she lives with her parents or should be living with her parents to give her that burner phone so that they could continue to communicate all throughout 2024. Also in Feb of 2024, the parents obviously are getting pissed and they say, I'm assuming it's the parents, we need you to do a welfare check. We need you to find our daughter. We think she's up there in the Hollywood Hills with that singer named David. And he's an adult, she's a child. Apparently, according to the document, the police actually find David's phone number in Celeste's phone. So they call him. And they don't just call him because when they call him, he says, I haven't spoken to her since Feb 13 or 14 in 2024, right? So that's days ago. I haven't spoken to her in days. So they go to his house. They made the phone call, but now they decide, I think we need to go there. Going to do an actual welfare check. And when they get to his home in the Hollywood Hills, he says to them, you know, I didn't know she was 13. Did not know that. And not only that, I have not seen her much because I only met her one time in person. I've only met that girl one time in person in November of 2023. This is what this allegation says against David when they're at the welfare check at his home in the Hollywood Hills. Because, you know, they're looking for a runaway. He says, yeah, I didn't know she was 13. And frankly, I didn't know she was a minor. I'd only met her once in person, November of 2023. Coincidentally, I think you remember me saying 2023 was when the allegations are that they began their sexual relationship. So that may not be true. And if that is the case, if these allegations are true, maybe there'll be more charges of lying to the police and obstructing justice. Because that's what that is, when you tell the police a lie. So weirdly, even though David is telling this welfare check police officer, I don't know what you're talking about. Really don't know much about her. Only met her once in person, you know, back in November 2023. 2 days later, Celeste is home. Who told her to go home 2 days after that? Coincidence? Maybe. Then it's after that that the allegations here say he drove to Lake Elsinore. David drove to Lake Elsinore and paid a junior high school student in Celeste's class $1,000 to give her a cell phone that he himself had purchased so that they could stay in contact. And apparently that happens all throughout the year 2024. And they say that Celeste spent a significant amount of time visiting with the defendant, including summer weekends at his home in the Hollywood Hills and traveling with him to Las Vegas and London and even Texas to meet his family. She's 13, bro. It is hard to believe. There are text messages in this memorandum that allege there are references between David and Celeste of sex and pregnancy and abortion and the use of Plan B emergency contraceptive, as well as explicit photographs documenting and corroborating what's alleged to be a sexual relationship between the two of them. So that's important, right? Because if you're trying to allege sex, if you weren't there to witness it, how else do you prove it? Well, with text messages and pregnancy, abortion, Plan B, all these things, that discussion doesn't come up if you're not actually doing it, right? If you're not actually having sex, it doesn't come up necessarily. Then in November of 2024, the defendant and the victim broke up. Celeste and David broke up, according to this, but continued to communicate. And the text messages suggest the sexual relationship continued as well. Then we get to April 23rd, which we've wondered when it was Celeste actually died. And the investigators say they pinned it to April 23rd. And there's a good reason for that. All of her cellular activity ceased on that day. That's a good indication. I don't think she was going to a monastery to contemplate life at age 13, 14, right? 14 years old. Everything stops. No more communications from her phone. But the night before, something very telling happened. And let me just get you up to speed. The prior night, April 22nd, 2025, the defendant and the victim engaged in a lengthy argument described in detail in their text messages. The messages revealed the victim's jealousy over defendant David's relationship with other women, as defendant led her to believe that they had a future together. This memorandum continues. She became extremely upset and threatened to disclose damaging information about her relationship with the defendant to end his career and destroy his life. Coincidentally, defendant's first studio album was due to be released April 25th, in just 3 days. He had an emerging multi-million dollar career already in progress. He had multiple product endorsements, which were highly profitable. So you can see where this, you know, where this briefing is going. Basically, she's angry. He's apparently having relationships with other girls. They've broken up, but they still continue on all their business and communications. And she's now saying, I'm mad. I don't like that. So I'm going to tell on you. Because I'm underage, you're not, it could ruin you completely. So that, again, is on April the 22nd. And you know what? I want to tell you about something you may have forgotten from 7 months ago. We have seen video of Twitch live streams with David and Celeste. And there is a freak out when messages start coming in suggesting you're done, bro, I got you on 4K, you're like the Epstein files. I'm paraphrasing some of them, but suddenly David freaks out, yo, yo, yo. And then there's a conversation between David and Celeste where he says, I media trained you. And she says, no, you didn't. And what, am I against having sex with minors or something like that? I'm going to let you see this, but it starts to show you the panic and fear about knowing about the severity of what it means for someone who is of the age of majority behaving like that with someone who might be 13 or 14. Take a look at this.
Pray for his career chat. Are we done?
We need to delete this.
Moz, can we delete all VODs? And then as soon as the stream ends, delete the stream too? Can we delete everything? You done for, bro? Y'all are not done? Now you gonna abstain? Yo, wait.
Oh, look at it. Answer that one. That's so mean if you don't answer
Which one? What's good, David? Big fan, big spammy. Oh, thank you, Mitch. Mitochondria? Appreciate
you. I personally don't.
Yo, I media trained you.
No, you didn't.
That's controversial.
It's controversial of raping kids.
Really good. Okay, it's been a good one. Bye.
Bye, guys.
Mwah, 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 mwah.
Wow, that's interesting. Certainly in retrospect of all these charges and knowledge of the law and how old she actually is, why would you freak out like that? Why would you freak out and then hit your mute button? Okay, let's keep going, shall we? Because this is extraordinarily informative. This episode is brought to you by Wild Grain. If you love really good fresh bread, but you don't have time to hunt down a bakery, this is honestly one of the easiest food subscriptions I've tried. Wild Grain sends baked from frozen sourdough breads, pastries, and even fresh pasta straight to your door. Everything is made with simple ingredients that you can actually pronounce. So it tastes incredible and it's easier on your tummy. Best part is you just pop it in the oven, no thawing, no prep, and in about 25 minutes, your kitchen smells like a bakery. And don't just take my word for it. They have over 40,000 five-star reviews and have been voted the best food subscription box by USA Today for 3 years in a row. For a limited time, Wild Grain is offering my listeners $30 off your first box plus free croissants for life when you go to wildgrain.com/Banfield to start your subscription today. That's $30 off your first box and free croissants for life at wildgrain.com/Banfield or just use the promo code Banfield at checkout. So again, there's this big argument on the 22nd of April. And the next night, on the 23rd of April, the police say at 8:40 p.m., April 23rd, defendant sent an Uber to transport the victim from her Lake Elsinore home to his residence. I'm assuming that's where her parents are. Maybe she's home at this point with her parents at this time. And the allegation is he's basically bringing her to the Hollywood Hills the night after their big argument and her threat that she's going to ruin his career just, you know, 3 days before he's got his first big studio album dropping. The allegation says they communicated before and during her Uber ride, which dropped her off at defendant's Hollywood Hills home at about 10:10 p.m. Important time. At approximately 10:30 p.m., defendant sent text messages to the victim inquiring where she was. She's already arrived 20 minutes prior at your home. Why are you sending text messages to her 20 minutes after she's gotten to your home? You're about to find out what they allege happened in those 20 minutes. And it is jaw-dropping. The allegation here is that the people, meaning the government, the DA, the police, believe that he's sending these messages because he's already killed her. He killed her when she walked in the door at 10:10 when she was dropped off by the Uber. The allegation is that he's covering his tracks and pretending that he's reaching out to her. Where are you? Hey, what's up? Let's talk. Whatever the messages are. They're saying that this is a big old cover-up. You killed her, and now you want to make it look like, yeah, no idea where she was. You're calling her to find out where she is. You're texting her. What's up, girl? Right? That's what the allegation is. But they say by the time these texts go out at 10:30, she's already dead. knowing he had to silence the victim before she ruined his music career, as she had threatened. Very soon after her arrival at his home, defendant stabbed the victim to death multiple times and stood by while she bled out. So this is quick. Uber drops her off at 10:10. Front door's right there. Takes about 8 seconds, maybe 5 seconds to get from the door of the Uber to the front door. The allegation is he's lying in wait and he's ready to kill her the moment she walks in the door. And by 10:30, she's dead and he's texting to make it look like he didn't know anything about where she is. So the allegation goes. So this continues on to say the defendant drove to Santa Barbara County immediately after the victim died, attempting to dispose of her property and destroy evidence. At approximately 11:30 p.m. on April 23rd. So this is 1 hour after, presumably, she's already dead and he's pretending to send her messages, right? It's an hour and 20 minutes after she's shown up at his door in that Uber. At 11:30 p.m., he drove away from his home as he texted and called the victim's phone asking where she was. Calling, texting, where are you, girl? All the while, she's dead. I don't know where she is. I don't know if she's back at the house at this point, allegedly, or if she's in the Tesla with him, allegedly, as he's driving to Santa Barbara. The weird thing is, he ends up in Santa Barbara and spends quite a lot of time there and doesn't come home until early the following morning of April 24th. So what was he doing all night long from 11:30 at night when he departs his home to early the next morning when he comes home? Don't know. Don't know. But he's got a radio interview that day. Wow. I'd have canceled that one if that were me. He's got a radio interview apparently scheduled to promote the release of his big new album because that's supposed to drop the next day after that on April 25th. We found a podcast interview. We don't know if a radio interview or a podcast interview is just language. We're not sure if this is the actual interview, but we found an interview that was posted on April 28th. Just 4 days later. And I don't know if this is the interview, but let me play a piece of it for you because it talks about his music and his famous song. And if you know his famous song, Romantic Homicide, let me remind you of a couple of the lyrics of his famous song before I play this radio interview. In the back of my mind, you died and I didn't even cry. No, not a single tear. And I'm sick of waiting patiently for someone that won't even arrive. Oh, 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 in the back of my mind, I killed you. And I didn't even regret it. I can't believe I said it. Because it's true. But it's true. I hate you. So that's Romantic Homicide, the lyrics. Here's the interview we found that posted 4 days after the morning he returned from this trip, allegedly out to Santa Barbara, having just allegedly stabbed his underage girlfriend to death.
And I played it for my mom. And whenever my mom hates something, I know it's cool. Like when I used to go get up and get dressed for school in the morning, I put on this cool fit. She was like, take that off, put on a suit or something like that. You know, I knew it was cool if she hated it. I played it for her in the car and she was like, David, this song is too violent. You're talking about killing people in your music? No, not my son. And I was like, wait, I might be onto something. So I dropped it right after that. And it went crazy. TikTok viral, 1 million views overnight. I was like, oh yeah, we cook it, boy. We cook it, boy. So,
well, your mom was right, David. That stuff is violent. And that does surprise most people, pretty much all people, except for a very sick few. So, okay, in the name of art, I'll give you that. But given the allegations against you, that is some batshit, next level crazy stuff that you're saying. Holy shit. And that you're singing about and that you allegedly perpetrated. Wow. All right, so let's carry on because this allegation continues to say that he sent two more texts to Celeste's phone on April 24th, radio day, radio interview day, right? Which obviously went unanswered because she's dead. And then after April 26th, which is the day after the album drop, right? All within 2 days of this, defendant never attempted to contact her again. Now, why is that? Why, David, would you never want to contact her again? because there's no point because you've already covered up your tracks, allegedly. Wow. That's the kind of thing where you say, this is someone who thinks they're really smart. I'll just cover my tracks by sending texts. And then you just stop on the 26th, which makes you look so incredibly guilty. So here's what happens after that, because this gets even more macabre and disgusting. Remember, he's allegedly killed her on April 23rd and then driven out all that night into April 24th and done something in Santa Barbara and come back that next morning and done a radio interview where he's talking about the grisly stuff. And then April 25th, the next day, album drops. April 26th, a couple more texts to make it look like I'm still looking for you. Where are you, girl? And then that's it. Never talk to her again. But other things happened after that date. He purchased a whole bunch of things. I'm actually going to talk about things he purchased on May 1st, right? Because that's like another week later. But before I do that, I do want to tell you that he did do something, allegedly, on the day that he was ordering the Uber and having Celeste come over. He ordered something from Home Depot and had it delivered by Postmates. And if you've ever used Postmates, you know it's kind of like you can call and have it delivered right away. You don't have to wait for Amazon a couple of days, whatever. You can call them, and like Uber Eats, it's coming to your door. And wouldn't you know what it was that he ordered from Home Depot on the day that he's sending the Uber to pick up Celeste? A shovel. Again, allegedly, it's David. That's what the memorandum says, right? That is what this incredible briefing says. So he's getting a shovel delivered, like Uber Eats. He's having a shovel delivered to his house that exact time that he's having Celeste come over. And then, maybe that's the business in Santa Barbara, but the shovel was just like, bro, this is a pain. This is hard. I don't want to do this. I don't know. Why'd you get the shovel? What'd you do with the shovel? Why'd you come back and you still apparently have Celeste's body in your Tesla? Maybe the shovel wasn't going to do the trick. Who knows? But then on May 1st, David ordered, allegedly, from Amazon, two chainsaws to be delivered to his home. 4 days later on May 5th, he ordered and Amazon delivered a body bag. Holy shit. Who orders a body bag on Amazon and has it delivered to your actual home? According to this incredible briefing, David does. Not just a body bag, y'all. Heavy-duty laundry bags and a blue inflatable pool. He does this under a fake name, Victoria Mendez. And on May 8th, this is just 3 days later, he returns to the same area in Santa Barbara County that he went on the 23rd/24th. Leaves his home around 11:30 at night and does another trip again on May 31st. So May 8th all the way to May 31st, he makes another trip there. Apparently, this is an isolated site off of SR Route 154. And guess what was found there eventually? Took a while to find it. Took until January 2026, you know. But they found Celeste's ID. They found her ID there, they say in this briefing. And then, as if though that wasn't enough, because we still know Celeste's body was not buried out in Santa Barbara County. What was going on out there? What was happening out there? Don't guess yet, because there's still more to come. But we know her body was not left or buried or anything out in Santa Barbara County, any of the trips that he allegedly went out there, because her body was found in his Tesla rotting September of 2025. So we know that the body was never taken out to Santa Barbara and left there. Why was the ID there? Like, what was going on in this rural location? Again, don't guess yet, because there's more coming. Because I know you're thinking, well, maybe that's where the dismemberment happened and all the rest. Nope. Not according to this. So on July 7th, right? So we've gone from May 31st, he's gone back out to Santa Barbara. Maybe he left the body out there. Maybe. Because he's trying to figure out what to do. But in any case, on July 7th, this document suggests the defendant ordered and Amazon delivered a burn cage to his home. And you know that Steve Fisher, the private investigator, was in that home and saw the burn cage. We put it on the air. We put it on this podcast. Like, Jesus, who has a burn cage in their home when they live in the middle of the Hollywood Hills? You're not out burning brush, you know? It's not like a rural property. That burn cage was in that home. So he's ordered and Amazon delivers a burn cage and uses the same fake name, Victoria Mendez. And then this is where it gets really grisly. This is where the allegation says the defendant took horrifying measures to destroy and discard the victim's body. Let me read directly from this briefing. After placing her body into the blue inflatable pool, because that's one of the things he purchased on Amazon, allegedly, to prevent her blood from spilling onto his garage floor, defendant used a chainsaw and perhaps other tools to cut off her limbs. Small blue plastic fragments were found embedded in the victim's remains, which were collected by the Los Angeles County Medical Examiner's Department. They were examined by the LAPD's Forensic Science Division, and they were a physical match from the blue fragments from the blue inflatable pool. In order to distance himself, this goes on to say, from the victim, he amputated her left ring and pinky fingers because her ring finger contained a tattoo of his name. Her fingers have never been recovered. Defendant then placed her head and torso into the cadaver bag that he purchased. He placed her limbs into a garbage bag, which he deposited in his front trunk, laying the cadaver bag on top. For several weeks, or possibly months, defendant left the victim's body to decompose inside his Tesla. He lied to friends, business associates, and others who noticed a strong smell of decay in and around his home and his vehicle. Okay, can I just stop for a second? You have a body rotting inside your Tesla, inside your garage, at your home. People are noticing the smell, and you're just going about business, allegedly? Holy shit. Who are you? And again, if all this is true, how fucking dumb are you? Okay, let's go on. Before leaving on his concert tour at the end of July, he parked his Tesla on the street around the corner from his home. This is like 400 feet away. Like, this is going to help? You got business to do. You got your concert tour and all the rest to deal with. So, like, I just got to put this thing on the back burner for a bit. But I don't want to do it in my garage because what if someone opens the frunk and sees it? So I better just park it on the street where maybe the wind will carry the smell away. And no one will ever notice the car parked on the street with the smell of decomposing human remains inside. Again. Dolt and sick motherfucker. I'm going to add that to it too, if this is true. The LAPD, of course, we all know, served a search warrant on the defendant's home in the Hollywood Hills. We saw that happening. We saw them coming out with boxes of stuff. Inside the garage, detectives discovered evidence consistent with the dismemberment of the victim's body. An inflatable pool which contained multiple linear cuts. Because, yeah, if you're using a chainsaw and you're cutting through someone, it's going to hit the bottom of the pool and that's going to get cut up and maybe get embedded into the body parts, which was what they allege happened, is exactly what happened.
Wow.
Several biological samples, which tested positive for blood, were collected within the garage. DNA analysis determined the various samples matched the victim's. On December 9th, 2025, the medical examiner ruled the victim's death a homicide caused by two penetrating injuries to the torso. So there's your murder, right? It wasn't that, oh no, what if she OD'd and I just needed to, you know, I freaked out. I didn't kill her, but, you know, I freaked out and I covered up the crime. Nope. No. Because the ME says it was two penetrating injuries to her torso that caused the death. Homicide means man kills man, not suicide, which is, oh no, I OD'd. Okay? So let's be clear. Because I know originally the LAPD said, we're not even sure if a crime is committed. Okay, I got so much to say about that. I'm going to say that in subsequent interviews. But they knew. They knew. They just needed to get the pieces together. Right? So the evidence, they list it all out here. It's really compelling. Description of photographs depicting the victim naked, as well as while she was engaged with the defendant in sexual activity when she was only 13. Oh, that's a crime, allegedly, in this. This is an interesting little piece that follows that. It says, while all possible charges that could be proven were not filed, that alone that I just read is proof of an ongoing naughty relationship when she was just 13 and 14. That I seized on because those charges could still come. Lots of them, right? Depending on how many episodes and dates they can actually prove with photos and digital evidence, there could be dozens, hundreds of these charges. So I love that they've actually said, well, all possible charges that could be proven were not filed. Hey, wait for it, because they don't have to charge everything at once. And oftentimes they don't. They amend their charging documents and indictments, and they can charge more. Happened to Diddy. There was amended indictments there. Numerous text messages between the defendant and the victim, evidencing their naughty relationship. I'm trying to keep the language about sex down because YouTube doesn't like it. I'll just say naughty when I mean you know what. So numerous text messages between defendant and the victim, evidencing their naughty relationship, pregnancy, abortion, and use of Plan B emergency contraception. Messages through March 2025 prove defendant continued to manipulate the victim as she messaged the following. Ready? This is Celeste saying, quote, all we do is have sex and just hang out, man. I want more than that for myself. End quote. They got that out of her iCloud data, according to this document. A little further on in this briefing doc, they say surveillance video. Oof. That's never good. Surveillance video of defendant driving his Tesla on July 29th, 2025 for the last time before parking the vehicle and leaving on tour at the end of July. Oh boy. Parking that car. Now I'm assuming that means parking that car in the place where it stayed, right? And it stayed there for a very long time because the neighbor said it had been there for a very, very long time. And they smelled the evidence of stench. They actually thought, one of the neighbors thought, they'd buried their dog out near that area. And they actually thought, according to Steve Fisher, that they were going to have to unearth that dog because apparently the smell was so bad. They couldn't understand it. Why would we have to unearth that dog and do something else? They thought the smell might have been coming from the dog because it was just over the hedges from that Tesla. This is more evidence listed out. Proof of defendant's Amazon purchases and deliveries. Two chainsaws, a body bag, an inflatable pool, heavy-duty laundry bags, and a burn cage. Proof of a Postmates delivery of a shovel on April 24th. Uber records, obviously, right? Proof of defendant's lucrative career. Text messages where the victim threatened to expose the defendant and destroy his career. And wouldn't you know it, TMZ unearthed the Twitch stream of all Twitch streams. It's David and a couple of his pals, I guess, associates, colleagues, whatever. And they are live streaming about 2 months after this alleged murder takes place. So if you're to believe everything in this unbelievable brief, the house stinks. And people have been saying the house stinks. What's going on? The garage smells, the Tesla smells, the house smells. And he's telling anybody who will listen, who comes over, who comes within a smelling distance of the car, nothing to see here. And guess what? He actually brings up this topic in this Twitch stream. Again, this is from TMZ.
Oh, we're yelling at you. I'm not closing in. Can you put this in the back too? Well, she don't mind. Can you put...
Oh, yeah. His nails turned back.
F*** you, bro. I'm looking at your packing, bro. Go f*** yourself. I don't even get paid, guys. I'm not even getting paid for this bullshit, bro. F*** this, bro. F*** all y'all dead ass.
Yeah. Oh. Now, do we make up?
Yeah. ABC.
Oh, yes. Didn't expose you? I apologize in advance for the way my bathroom smelled. I took a shit on 2 hours ago.
I don't care. I just took a shit.
Another one? Type shit. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about.
Yo. I had to go.
If you want to join us,
look
at my wall.
Wow. Wow. You just offered that up, that sorry about the way my bathroom smells. I just took a shit in there and they're all joking about it. But the guy, I'm not sure if that's Neo. I thought I heard the girl say Neo, but we know that he's got a friend named Neo who got into some trouble with the grand jury and not showing up. I don't know if this is him or not, but he gave that look at the end of this whole thing about, hey, sorry about how it smells in there. I just took a shit. I don't know if that's, wow, that language is inappropriate. I doubt it because of the way he himself is talking. Or, whoa, dude, I know what that is, and I can't believe you're saying it's typical bathroom smells. Take a look again. So, yeah, I mean, you be the judge, but wow, TMZ, good unearthing. Great stuff. I have a feeling that may make its way into the case. So, you probably already know this if you're a true crime fan. Or if you follow Court TV or podcasts like mine or Law and Crime or anything, or Nancy Grace or any of that, you probably know that there is a term that we use frequently for stuff that is like the stuff in here. Bad facts. Bad facts. I'm going to go a little further and say these are horrendous facts for David. David Burke has Everest to climb to get out of this shithole. This is bad. But it's not totally insurmountable. And I know you're saying, what are you kidding me? That sounds like everything all tied up with a little Christmas bow on it. Maybe not. And a lot of people are making a lot of hay about the fact that it took 7 months to charge him when this stuff is all readily available. Like, you had all this stuff? What on earth? I know, because I've covered a lot of cases with way less than this that get charged in a week, right? So that's interesting. There may be some there. And also, the way he eventually got arrested, the DA didn't charge him and then the police went and arrested him. It was the other way around. Like, the police arrested him first, and that's kind of unusual. And everybody was trying to figure out what's going on here. But there is somebody who knows a lot about the machinations of all of this and why all those little dates and times of when they arrested and when they didn't, and why such a long period of time between all this evidence and the eventual arrest, and why the police arrest before the DA actually had a chance to charge. Well, there are reasons, and they're good reasons. Like, they make a lot of sense when you hear from Matt Murphy, because Matt Murphy was in the business of prosecuting homicide in California. So I had a very, very long conversation with him, not just about the oh my God factor, and we go through the oh my God factor, but also the technical and why it was like, and I'll just describe it this way, why it was like Matt Murphy saying they were playing chess and David was playing tiddlywinks. Like, that's kind of the description of the conversation you're about to hear. So here, without further ado, is Matt Murphy, not only former homicide prosecutor in California, but also the author of The Book of Murder. Matt, it's good to have you. I think of people like you when I read details like this. What was your first impression when you saw this briefing document?
Well, okay, so I've got a little bit of an inside angle on this one. And also, it's kind of funny, this is the first time I've ever been on TMZ. And Harvey Levin had me on, and this was right after the LAPD arrested him. And he was actually really nice when I was on the show. And I'm doing a podcast now with Mark Garagos, who also has a podcast with Harvey Levin. So we were talking a little bit about that, and their take on it was, hey, there must be some big fracture here between LAPD and the LADA's office, right? Because they did this arrest, and for people that that don't know how it works, there's two different functions for a grand jury in the state of California. One is your traditional, like what you see on TV, grand jury. You go in, you present evidence, and you ask for an indictment. But in California, you can also convene what's known as an investigative grand jury, and they convened three of them over the course. Remember right when this happened, how there were all those people that were screaming, how come he's not under arrest yet? How come he's not under arrest yet? What the LADA's office did, and this is This is advanced level stuff. They convened an investigative grand jury, and the importance of that is when you have a, if you have people that are almost certainly in the know, that don't want to talk, the police show up at your door and they knock and say, hey, we want to interview you about this murder that we think your associate or your friend or your family member was involved in. Will you talk to us? The law says you don't have to do it. So in investigations like this, it's very common, Ashley, as you know, for people to say, pound sand, I'm going to get a lawyer, I'm not going to cooperate. And given what we know now, just jumping ahead for a second, anybody who do that on this case sucks as a human being. Okay, but let me go back. So what you do with an investigative grand jury is you can actually force them to talk. And I've done this before, where you bring them in and you bring down the presiding judge, and it's usually the presiding judge of the county, and you force upon them what's known as use immunity. And that means that their normal right against cross or against self-incrimination under the Fifth Amendment, you say, hey, judge, I'm granting him use immunity. This witness will not be prosecuted for anything that they say in this proceeding. We reserve the right to still prosecute them for other evidence that we get elsewhere on them. But for the purpose of this, they have no right to self-incrimination because we agree under this law, we can't use anything or any derivative of what they say against them.
But they can, by the way, just let me break in for a second there. Use immunity is only for this issue. Anything else, though, their words can be used against them some other time. Okay.
And not to get too deep in the weeds here, but I think your audience is up for this. So there's two kinds of immunity. There's use immunity like that, which is, hey, it's in federal court, they call it queen for a day. You tell us everything you know. We will not prosecute you based on what you tell us today or what we learn as a result of what you tell us today, the derivatives of what you say. The other kind of immunity is immunity. And if anybody, for the audience, anybody ever offers you immunity, like flat out, it's called transactional immunity, take it, confess to toilet papering the gym when you're in high school because you will get legal carte blanche on everything you say. But it's very rare. In my career, I offered that two times.
So you think they did this in this case, is that these grand juries that were convened to investigate offered use immunity to all the people who had, you know, zippers over their mouths, and then they finally squawked?
No, they didn't offer it. And that's what's so, for lack of a better term, just so awesome about what the LADS office did here. They forced it on them. So you have a reluctant witness, and you put them in there, and they sit down, and that is an intimidating room. You sit down, especially in L.A., because it's Orange County, it was like a basement under the courthouse. In LA, it's an intense place, and they're staring at, I think, 24 grand jurors who want to know what happened. And you issue a grand jury subpoena, you bring them in, the presiding judge comes in and says, I'm ordering you to answer these questions, and they talk. This is really advanced level stuff. And the attorney is Beth Silverman. I don't know her personally, but this is actually how I would have done it. And I could not be more impressed. And what they did is they took their time. They didn't let anybody make them rush. And on TMZ, I told Harvey Levin, I'm like, and his take was, there's a problem. And I'm like, nope, I really don't think so. And I'm glad I was right. But Nathan Hochman is the new DA of LA, and that guy is the real deal. And I can tell you, this would not have happened under George Gascon. This is a professional prosecutor giving the support for his professional prosecutors to do stuff like this. And they took their time. They did not bow to public pressure, and they have revealed this. And another thing I want to talk about real quick, that the moment when David's attorney got up there in court, remember that last week? And it's like, we cannot wait until the evidence sees the light of day. Remember that whole conversation that we all saw? And we're not waiving time for a preliminary hearing. And for those that have been in the business, they were waiving time no matter what. And everybody was going, oh, that's so brilliant. That's so great. As sure as the sun was going to rise, they were going to waive time. Okay, but that dramatic moment, you know, and I've never tried a case against her, but she's, you know, she's got a good reputation. But that was pure friggin' theater. And then the DA did something else that you never, ever see. So when the defense is up criticizing the DA's office and going, you know, we can't wait for the truth to come out, they filed a brief, which is where all the information you just covered came from. You never see that for a preliminary hearing. And procedurally, all they have to do is establish probable cause for this stuff.
Yeah, this was detailed.
Yeah, in California, you can do what's called a Prop 115 prelim, where you just put your main investigator on, and they can testify to hearsay. And all you got to do is get the ball over the net, probable cause established, game, set, match. You never see this kind of brief filed, and that was, I think, masterfully handled by Nathan Hochman in the LADA's office. And I got no dog in the fight here, and I don't know this prosecutor. That's what people voted for when they elected that guy, and they released all this information, and now we know. And I'll say another thing, not to cut you off. Let me just roll here for a second. I have, over and over again, you'll have these murder cases, Ashley, where you've got somebody, and they will, when people don't know how much work went into it, remember, grand jury is secret, so we don't have those transcripts yet. When people don't know, oftentimes you'll have their church group will call up, their book club will show up, like, this is not the person I know, you can't know. And sometimes as a prosecutor, this might be a case that you've worked on for 2 or 3 years where you know every single detail, but they have no idea what's going on behind the scenes. And so you'll have this cheering section, and then when stuff, you know, as evidence starts to come out, that cheering section gets smaller and smaller. There's nothing that repels supporters more. There's nothing that makes the church group, or in this case, a fan base, run for the friggin' exits faster than child pornography. And that is, and I don't know if we can even say that on whatever you're broadcasting on, child corn or whatever, that is, you lose all support. In this case, the way they mapped that out, this is exactly the way I would file it. This is masterfully done. David is cooked, and it's because of the professionalism of the prosecution working hand in hand with the LAPD. This is how you do it, and he's done.
Let me ask you this, because just looking at the evidence, the physical evidence and the digital evidence and the usual suspects of evidence and investigative product, I personally couldn't really understand why there was this need for 7 months of 3 grand juries and delay and an unusual charging process. It just felt like, to me, I've seen murder cases with not even an eighth of this much evidence. So why all the need for everything else? Why all the need for the extra and the 7 months? It seemed like to me that there's just incredible digital exhaust, and there's incredible physical evidence, and there's incredible video, and there's incredible pictures and texts.
You know, and the answer to that is you've got to remember, this is potentially a death penalty case. They receive the highest level of appellate scrutiny. That's an interesting call for Nathan Hochman on this. My guess is they're not going to seek it. I sat on our death penalty committee for 15 years and reviewed every special murder case in Orange County. We'd make a formal recommendation to the elected DA. Under Jackie Lacey, it was a guy named Joey Esposito, who I'm a huge fan of. He was the former shot caller in the LADA's office. And ultimately, it's the elected official that makes that call. We saw it in less than 4% of the cases that technically qualified for the death penalty. In LA, it was closer to 2. I don't think they do it on this because that changes the complexion of it. We have a moratorium. I don't think it's probably worth it. And then you go from, did he do it, which is the guilt phase, to, well, what kind of childhood did he have, and what did the victim do? I my guess is they don't seek it. But that said, this case will still receive the highest level of appellate scrutiny. And we're talking about downtown LA, and you're talking about a very famous young man that you have to make sure that you have an exhaustive amount of evidence. And the reason they took their time on it, and the reason that it was professionally done the way it was, at the end of the day, this family and this girl, and that's what she was a girl. She was 14 when she was murdered. But he started sexually abusing her at least when she was 13, if not younger. And I've heard people say you started dating her. You don't date a 13-year-old, not in the state of California. That's Section 288 of the California Penal Code. That's child molestation. That's sexual abuse of a child. And that's one of the things that they filed in there. But that's why you do it this way. This is, you don't rush to it. He wasn't a flight risk. He had no place to go. He's doing his tour or whatever. You keep an eye on him. And this was a random child that he murdered. This, he had a relationship with her, so I think they made the calculus that
let me ask you about that because, and again, these are all allegations not proven yet in a court of law, but
of course
the length of time, I always wonder if they're making him feel comfortable, tickling wires, getting him to do what, you know, young men of that age will often do, and that is eventually brag or confide in someone, and maybe there's a wiretap that will catch that. Is that possible that that's what this long lag in event to arrest might have been?
No doubt that that's a component to it, but also remember, this stuff, the three investigative grand juries means people, the term is holding their mud. They were, at the beginning, I guarantee there were people that had critical information in this investigation that were not giving it up. I also wouldn't be surprised if in the three investigative grand juries, if some of these witnesses were called back based on additional things in the investigation. So that, and use the term tickling the wire. So let me just make sure everybody understands what that means. And that's exactly the right term. It's called tickling the wire. Well, what you do is you set up a wiretap, which, by the way, you talk about advanced game. We've all seen The Wire on HBO, and there's this idea out there that wires are done all the time in state court. They are not. Going up on a wire is a huge deal. It has a whole, that it's so invasive, and it has such a, there's such privacy concerns with people that aren't subjects of the investigation, that you have to be really, you have to go through an entirely different part of the procedure. There's so many hoops you got to jump
through. Super judicious.
You have no
just
idea.
Super judicious, yeah.
So, a ton of stuff, and you're very limited, and you can only listen for a certain period of time. It's incredibly complex. However, tickling the wire is when you go through that exhaustive process. I hated doing wires on my cases. Hate it because it was so exhaustive, and you almost never got anything out of them. But what you do is once it's finally set up, then you go and you knock on the door of the person that you want to listen to. You knock on the door of the sycophant that's hanging on to the guy that you think might know something. You knock on the door of somebody in his professional circle that you think might know something. You knock and say, hey, we've got some information. We really want to interview you. And then that's called tickling the wire. And then you sit back and you see who they call. Or you see who he calls after getting that information. You send a text message. There's a million different things that police do to get people talking, and then you listen to what they have to say.
You kind of, for lack of a better way to describe it, you kind of freak them out a little, and then see who they call for help,
exactly,
and
right.
see who they call and explain their problem suddenly to.
It's exactly right. And the thing is, when you got a guy like this that he knows he's under the spotlight of suspicion. He had a relationship with this one girl, so it's not, he didn't snatch her off a bus bench someplace, so he's not likely to reoffend, and so they've got to put all this stuff together, and they've got to make sure they get every piece of evidence that they can before they hook him, for the exact reason that we saw. He's got money, he's going to hire a hotshot defense lawyer who's going to do what we saw. We're not waiving time. And I love that because Beth Silverman goes, cool, we're ready to go.
Today.
You know, and,
and just,
we
Matt,
call
explain
your bluff.
That. Explain that to folks, because we have a right to a speedy trial in this country. So explain the strategy that you're talking about so that it makes sense for this conversation.
Sure. So we're talking about process and due process rights. So anybody that's arrested for a felony anywhere in America, but especially in the state of California, you're arrested for a felony, you have a statutory period of time before your arraignment. They arrested him on a Friday, if you recall, which led to a lot of the speculation. They arrested him on a Friday, and which means depending on the hour that they arrest him, he either gets arraigned either on Monday or Tuesday. You have a set statutory time before you have to be arraigned. Okay, and that means they bring you to court. The arraignment is simply a formal process where a criminal defendant is advised of the charges against them. The defense lawyer will either continue the arraignment, or they will enter a plea. They'll deny all claims. They will request discovery pursuant to the law. Blah blah blah. There's a whole little script that you do as a defense lawyer in that. And then you set it for either continued proceedings or you set what's known as a preliminary hearing. A preliminary hearing is only to establish probable cause. And that's another thing that I am so impressed with Beth Silverman on this, because I sound like a cheerleader. I don't know any of these people. I know Nathan Hawken, but I don't know Beth. But you as a prosecutor, if you get an indictment, and it's really tempting to do that, like, hey, grand jury, you've gone through this three times with me. I'm now requesting an indictment. they issue what's called a true bill. But if you do that, you have to notify the defense. Oftentimes, you got to give them an opportunity because you have an obligation in front of a grand jury to present exculpatory evidence in the state of California. It's known as a Johnson right. But then you're limited to whatever they indict on. You're limited to the charges in the true bill. The way they have done it, and I love this, if you go via a preliminary hearing, it means you can adjust the filing, you can adjust your charges based on the evidence as it comes out. This is the way I used to do all of my cases. So this is the way to do it. And so the next right he's got procedurally is he has a right to a preliminary hearing to establish probable cause, and you have a preliminary hearing right for any felony, and you've got a right to have that done statutorily within a very short period of time. And that's when the attorney came out and said, we're not waiving time. We want the facts to come out as soon as possible. I love that because it's such a wah-wah-wah moment.
We're getting so deep in the weeds, and I haven't even gotten to the meat of the matter.
I'm nerding out on the procedure on this because this is
you
so,
do nerd out.
So
I love it though; it's great. So I want to talk about the meat on the bone here because it is sort of earth shattering to see this level of alleged planning and lying in wait, covering your tracks, protecting your financial success and future. And then just sort of the grisly matter of carrying out a murder like this and then hiding it all. And I just, like I said, I've covered cases with a fraction of this evidence. And I feel like they could have arrested him right away, given the amount they had. I get it that they wanted more, but did they really need more?
I mean, that's more art than it is science. You know, look, this is the same jury pool that acquitted O.J. Simpson. We're talking about downtown L.A., CCB. I think you want a complete investigation, and you do that for the Rivas family. You do that to make sure that you have to be patient on these things, and you really want to know every aspect of it. And it's to go up on wiretaps, like I said, it takes time. But yeah, look, when you're talking about the way they filed this, you've got a man, and this is alleged, he's presumed innocent, you know, but we're not in court right now either. He's got this relationship with a 13-year-old. Now, he was 18 when he first started seeing her. I think he met her online when he was gaming.
He was about 16 and she was 11 when they met. But the alleged sexual relationship didn't start till she was 13 and he was 18. Now he's a grown-up and she's still a middle schooler.
That's right. Okay, so, and what's interesting to me about that is that you have those cases. I did, we call them in Orange County SRVPs, statutory rape vertical prosecution. And I was assigned to that for a little while when I was in sex. You have, there's a quality of those where you've got, and I mean, look, every high school senior who has a high school senior girlfriend that's a little bit older who turns 18, like, we all know that's a thing, right? Like,
there's also the Romeo and Juliet.
To the prom
together. Like, there are kids that are, you know, close in age. They're in high school. One's 18, one's, you know, 16, and that shouldn't be considered a crime for
right. And it's and those are different. Okay, so when we look at this case, and you say, okay, he met her when he was 16. He's a kid, right? He's a minor. Did he fall in love with a 13-year-old? That's not a big age difference. Or she was 11, whatever. And you have to entertain that. And you wonder about that right up until you find out about child pornography. And then you realize if that's true, if they really did recover child pornography from his phone, F that guy, he's into little kids. And that's what that means. When I spent 4 years in sexual assault, Ashley, whenever you have an allegation of sexual abuse, and you really can't prosecute those cases unless you have some form of corroboration, case after case after case, if you got into the phone of that high school senior that we talked about, or his computer, you're not going to find any kiddie porn in that.
Well, I want to be really clear. We don't know what kind of allegation there is of child porn. What we know is that he's charged with lewd, lascivious acts with a minor under 14, and that there are photographs allegedly of Celeste naked on his phone, and there are images and videos of them engaging in sex. So by definition, that's, you know, that would be the child, I'll say corn, just to make sure I don't get knocked off YouTube. But yeah, so the, I'm not sure that there's anybody else. We've heard there allegations of others, of other minors who've complained that they were with them in that way.
There might not be, but when Nathan Hochman came out and announced that in response, I think, to what the defense did, when they came in and said, we can't wait for all this to come out, and they said, cool, well, here you go. I interpreted that, and you're right. It hasn't been made public. And these are images we will never see and we never should see, whatever they are. But look, I've worked a bunch of sex cases. The modern corroboration you want is that material. If there's an accusation against an adult and it's an accusation of sexual abuse of a child, when you get into their devices and you see that kind of pornography, you know that it's true. Jurors know it's true. That's not a normal thing for people to have. I mean,
can I ask you something? That just makes me think. Did the grand jurors, did they see these alleged images of Celeste having sex as a minor with David?
We don't would know. They? Okay, it's secret.
The grand jury, would they? Like, what secret? I'm saying is, generally speaking, would grand jurors see those kinds of images?
It depends on when they got his devices, and that's something I don't know. Was this material taken off the phone that he had on him during his arrest? I know they got into all of his stuff.
They got iCloud photos. They got a lot of things. But I guess my question is, we're never going to see them, and that's clear and that's obvious. But let's just say in a potential murder trial, will jurors see those images and those videos? They will. They will have to see all of it.
They will absolutely see those. And what another thing that's interesting is, and you raise a really good point here, we don't know what they are. We don't know if it involves other minors. It might just be her, which satisfies all the statutes. Even if somehow he were able to, you know, pull off a Hail Mary here and get the world's worst jury, which ain't going to happen, I can tell you right now. But even if they did, the possession of that material alone federally, you could do, I think the federal statutory minimum is like 15 years. So he's done however you skin this cat. But that's not going to happen. And they can introduce that. The continuous sexual abuse of a minor is 288.5 of the California Penal Code. And I've done those cases too. And that is no joke. And that type of material will come in to prove that, especially if it's images that show her.
Can you charge somebody with that crime at a state level and then go ahead and charge them again with that same crime at a state? That's not a double jeopardy if you're going to do a state and a federal?
Number one, yes, you can. It's called the Petit Rule. Yes, you can. You can prosecute somebody twice, once in state, once in federal, depending on the charge. But if you notice, they didn't charge him. And if I'm right here, it's brilliant the way they did. They didn't charge him with possession of child pornography. Right. They charged him with continuous sexual abuse of a minor, for which that will be admitted as evidence.
Right.
But what that does is that removes that issue. So now it's served up for the feds to take it they're walking with a net now, and the feds can still do it and probably will in this case.
Interesting. So
this was professionally done. I mean, this is the way it's supposed to be done.
Even if he skates on the first degree murder with special circumstances, which would be life, no parole, or death penalty, he could be looking at a lengthy state set of charges for the lewd, lascivious acts with a minor under 14. And then
potentially life. Yeah.
And I don't even know how many. Right. Exactly, because I don't even know how many instances they found on the phone. There could be
we don't know.
Dozens. This is a years-long relationship, allegedly. So he could be put away for life, even if he skates on murder.
And I wasn't a federal prosecutor, so I haven't prosecuted one of these federally. I'm sure there's a way that they could soup it up to get a life sentence out of this, considering what he's charged with doing. But another really interesting thing about this, Ashley, is when you look at when you investigate murder cases like this, or you prosecute murder cases like this, you've got this, he does this. There's a saying in the law, never commit a felony to cover up for a misdemeanor, right? So as the allegation goes, and what it appears they found on the cloud, right, is that she's going to rat him out for this inappropriate sexual relationship, and he's about to release this album, right? So he kills her to shut her up, which is where the witness charge comes in. But you go through this, he, you know, gets online, which is incredibly stupid to do, and his, he uses like an alias, but it goes to his house. How do they connect the dots with the burn cage and the chainsaws, two chainsaws, and the kiddie pool, which is, there's a really dark humor connection there. Kiddie pool, I don't know, my twisted brain, like, I just think it's, he cut her up in a kiddie pool. For anybody that's ever been to a scene, by the way, where a body has been dismembered, the idea that he thinks he's going to not have viscera everywhere, you know, I mean, and I could tell you a really a super dark story about a scene like that with the feds, if you want me to. But anyway, he goes through all this. He knows how much trouble he's in. He kills her to avoid, you know, being ratted out. And then he gets 90% of the way there, and he leaves her in his freaking trunk. It's like,
I can't,
you know,
even.
It's the stupidest thing ever. And that's a Tesla. And they have a thing called an EDR in a Tesla. So that's an electronic data recorder. And when all the crazies were burning the Tesla dealerships and keying the Teslas that was going on for a while, maybe
they're all getting caught on the Tesla
cams. Because there's cameras all over Teslas. I guarantee you, Ashley, that the person who parked that car that's in the EDR, that's already been downloaded, and I'll bet you it's David. And
well,
if it's not
interesting.
David,
interesting. You have to you have to turn that on. It's not just automatic. You have to enable that as the owner of the Tesla. I don't know that that's where the images are saying we have him on surveillance, being the last person to drive that car and park it. But I do know that Steve Fisher, the investigation expert, the PI, I believe he got surveillance video from a home nearby that actually showed that. So, I mean, it does defy logic. Other than, I think there's a freak out potentially happening. He needs to get his business done, and he needs to get that stinking car out of the garage, because the allegations in this description are that friends and business associates and people who are visiting are complaining about the smell of the car in the garage. And so I think he's still trying to maybe perhaps use the burn unit or the burn cage. He's still trying to figure out, how do I get rid of the body? But I'm busy. I still have to get my music tour kicked off. So I'll park that over there for a while, and hopefully the wind will keep everything masked.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the
allegedly
thing, right? It's like, it's 90% taking care of what he needs to take care of in his mind, and then you blow it in the ninth inning. Like, she'd run away from home multiple times. You know, and I don't want to coach anybody on how to get rid of a body, but if you could dump somebody in the chaparral in California, I can't tell you how many of those cases I've had, Ashley, where the coyotes and the animals get to him. It's called being scavenged. And, you know, there'd be nothing left of her in, you know, 3 or 4 days. She would be a skeleton. You could do that in Hollywood. I had cases where bodies were dumped in Hollywood where, you know, there's nothing left after a couple of days. You know, literally, it's skulls and bones.
I still can't figure out the Santa Barbara County trips. Like, the allegation is that April 22, they have a fight. April 23, he lures her over to, you know, with the Uber, sends the Uber. That's when they say she's dead, because her messages all stop. All phone calls and messaging stop April 23. Then that night, she's supposed to arrive at 10 o'clock at night in the Uber, but I think at 11:30 or almost midnight, he's allegedly on his way in the Tesla to Santa Barbara County, spending almost all night there and coming back on now the 24th to do his radio interview. He comes back home on the morning of the 24th and then goes out and does his radio interview, and the album drops the next day on the 25th. What is happening in Santa Barbara that you've come home and you still have the body? And if the dismemberment and everything happened in the garage, what was happening in Santa Barbara? Because that's where they found her ID. So I'm mixed up about that.
There's two parts to that. Number one, he's trying to, number one, part A, he's not smart. This guy's a friggin' idiot. Okay, so that's number one. I guess the answer, it's like, there's this great line from the show Band of Brothers. They ain't as smart as me and you. I mean, that's the first part. But what he's trying to do is he's trying to establish some sort of an alibi, because while he's in Santa Barbara, he starts calling her phone saying, where are you? How come you're not picking up? That's the purpose of that, which is also, it's like 50% smart, 50% idiot because he's thinking about cell phones and he's thinking, he wants to be able to say, hey, the night she disappeared, I was in Santa Barbara, guys. Like, he's thinking about that without thinking, all of my text messages with her are downloading to the cloud.
So it's, everything yeah, from an hour into 50% before.
Complete yeah. fool. But also the amount of areas, I went to UCSB, so the amount of rural canyons and dirt roads and places that he could have, like, I mean, a shallow grave in one of those places, her body would never have been recovered, and they'd have to be looking at this whole thing as a missing body case, which complicates it. You know, I you can still prosecute those cases. I did a bunch, but it complicates it. But all he really needed to do is dump her in a canyon someplace. And so that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to establish an alibi. The second part about that that is really interesting to me is he's about to drop this album. And he's got a bunch of hangers-on. He's a very successful singer. He's up and coming. He's got fans. He's got other people in the music business. And remember, anybody, and I'm not suggesting for one second here that anybody did, but anybody who's aware of what happened to Celeste Rivas who helps him, that's a crime in the state of California. In almost every state besides California, you can be sentenced to 50% of whatever they did as an accessory after the fact. California's different. Wow. You can only do... It's a 36-month maximum. It's called a PC-32. It's accessory after the fact. You can do 18 months in state prison for something like that.
So, well, Matt, now that you say
anybody
that.
In his world, and I think we're going to see okay. a bunch of immunity offers when this thing comes around from the people.
Maybe this is the Santa Barbara thing. So, because this is what I'm wondering. None of the chopping up has happened yet because you haven't even ordered the chainsaws and the baby pool yet. That comes a few days later in May. So at that night, Celeste is a body. I don't know if she's in the Tesla going to Santa Barbara. I don't know if he's only going to Santa Barbara to do what you say, meaning I don't even know what you're talking about. I was in Santa Barbara calling her. She wasn't answering. Or if he's meeting with someone there to say, oh my God, what do I do? I need a cleaner. Because he returns to Santa Barbara a couple times, right? And that's where they ultimately find her ID. But the allegation is that the dismemberment, et cetera, happened in the garage. And then the body bags and the garbage bags are just in the Tesla for potentially weeks or months in his garage yeah. while friends and associates and folks in the house are complaining about the smell. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, he's... this is one of the many reasons why this guy is done, because he is stupid. My old investigator, Larry Montgomery, who was born on the planet Earth actually to solve murder cases, he used to say that killers are dice throwers. They're not chess players. And this is a really good example of that. Or there's another old adage that you hear, we don't catch the smart ones, you know, and I don't want to be glib, and I don't want to take away from the investigative work that we've seen. This is professional. And this, I mean, for 4 years in LA County, we didn't see anything like this because of the administration. And, you know, a parallel to this, Ashley, this is where we are seeing the opposite of this is in the Savannah Guthrie case. Okay, leadership matters in criminal prosecution and investigations. It is incredibly important. Experience and leadership really, really counts. It's important for morale. But when you're talking about assembling a case like this, Nathan Hochman gave his deputy, Beth Silverman, the support and the ability to go out and do this and to take her time despite getting heat in the media. And I cannot tell you how impressed I am by that, because this is not the way it happens. Savannah Guthrie's mom, Nancy Guthrie, is missing today because Chris Nanos is terrible. But more importantly than that, we're seeing it in this case. The top law enforcement official of Pima County is a woman named Laura Conover. She's the DA. She was a lifetime criminal defense lawyer, was elected in 2020. She's never prosecuted a murder. She's never worked a task force with the FBI. She has no idea how any of that stuff works. And that's why Savannah Guthrie's mom is still missing today, because we have no professionals working that case. FBI, wonderful, them aside, it's a Pima County case. This is the opposite of that. This is when you get the DA, the elected DA, giving his prosecutor the resources that she needs and a collaborative working relationship with the investigating agency, the LAPD. This is how cases are done professionally.
This is also a target-rich environment. I mean, like, literally, this was almost like shooting fish in a barrel when you look at everything they got. The cell phone records, the text messages, the photographs, and again, all allegations. However, they've gathered things from her cloud, from his cloud. They've got photos, they say, of her naked and them engaging in that illegal, you know, sexual behavior. They've got the kiddie pool that's got the blue fragments in, embedded in her remains. They've got the chainsaws, the burn cage all being ordered under a fake name to his home. They've got the Tesla information. They've got the phone calls that are made right after she's already arrived at his house. He's calling her and suggesting, why aren't you calling me back? I don't know where you are, and I'm trying to establish the fact that I'm not with you. I mean, and then suddenly on the 26th, which is just 2 days later, he never makes another phone call to her again. He never tries to reach her again. There's no contact between them again. So again, I look at this just like that, just the digital trail alone was just so simple. But I will say this, when you have a digital trail, sometimes you don't know whose hands are on the devices. Is that the trouble with this case if you're thinking as your adversary, which would be the defense attorney for him?
Well, I've done cases like that, as you know, like my Daniel Wozniak case. The killer actually took his victim's cell phone and used it to lure somebody else, Julie Kibushi, a second victim, to his first victim's home, murdered her to make it look like the first guy did it. So you're absolutely right. That's the thing. In this case, I don't think so, because he's the one that stands to lose here. He's about to drop the album, and she's threatening to expose him. And I think, remember, every one of these cases is a collage. They're all collages of evidence, and it's the big picture. It's the tiny little details. You put them all together, you take a step back, and you look at every piece of evidence in light of every other piece of evidence. So like the drives to Santa Barbara, where's her ID found? Okay, we call that a clue. It's the fact that from his devices, I guarantee he got rid of whatever phone was downloading to the cloud, right? Thinking that then he would get rid of those communications. That's known as consciousness of guilt. And then she's found in his car. This is all things that are in his control. His IP address ordered a burn cage, two different chainsaws, and that kiddie pool from Amazon. Like that, the idea that that he didn't have a direct hand in it. And remember, there's the only allegation in this entire case that he personally did it adds 1 year. He can be legally responsible for all of this stuff if it's somebody in his inner circle that did it for him, or there's somebody else that committed the murder. The personal use of a knife is the only thing that's a 1 year add-on to what should be a life without possibility of parole at very least. So it's a nothing thing. If somebody else is involved doing this to help him, all he has to do is have knowledge and he's done. Then he's a co-conspirator. He faces all the same criminal liability that he would if he was the actual killer, less 1 year.
Let me put this to you, because I feel like this is where the prosecution will go. He is about to become a multi-million dollar recording artist, and he is already surrounded, more than likely, I just assume, but I kind of know, by sycophants and hangers-on and the cadre of people that always show up with the star because they're getting something from him and their careers depend on him. So I can see a defense attorney saying, suddenly they're seeing this young girl who's going to blow it for all of them, and they're going to take care of business so that the golden goose can keep laying eggs. I guess the only argument to that would be, well, then why would you pin it on the golden goose by using his devices, by using his IP, by using his car, by leaving the body in his car? I guess that would be the argument against the defense's argument.
I think that you're almost certainly right. We're going to see some version of that in trial, and nobody's going to believe it. And that's all. And that's not a hack on the defense. It's they can probably only do something like that. But there's another problem with that, is that you can't point your finger at somebody in the state of California. You're not allowed to accuse people unless you have actual evidence to back it up. So it can't just be a mystery theory. Because there's going to be all the people in his inner circle are going to be identified, especially now because they took their time in putting this together. And for anybody that like the smell or that, and we can all picture the orbiters, like we just watched all that in the Diddy case, all these fools that are surrounding Diddy trying to advance their own careers, you know, like they're all just gross, right? We're about to see a whole brand new cast of the same kind of people. But the thing about those people is everybody is loyal until they start looking at consequences for themselves. And then suddenly, I've seen it a million times, their lips start moving real fast.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's what we've seen here. And look, again, if you have an amateur who goes and knocks on the door and says, tell us the truth, some amateur prosecutor or somebody that's not that experienced, maybe a defense lawyer says they don't have the firepower to do this. When Beth Silverman comes in and she's got three investigative grand juries and you don't know what they got yet, and that is as a defense lawyer representing either somebody, one of the also-rans or one of his orbiters, you have your come to Jesus conversation with them and you say, buddy, you are the first person on that witness bus, and if you freaking lie once, you're going to prison and I'm going to fire you. That's the conversation that you have. And like the real professional defense lawyers, there's a guy named John Barnett in Orange County who is like one of the most effective gunslingers I've ever seen. I used to go and I probably shouldn't say this, but when I was prosecuting big murder cases, we used to call it visiting the Oracle. He's got this house overlooking Laguna Beach, and I would go and pick his brain on strategy, like especially when I was up against a really good defense lawyer, like, John, what are they going to do here? He was awesome, and he would help me on cases that he had nothing to do with. This was so professionally done. You know, John's thing with his clients was, I want you to imagine, for people that were reluctant on ratting out their friend, their homeboy, whoever it was, I want to picture you, visualize yourself in state prison. I want you to visualize yourself in state prison the first night because you decided to be loyal. The people you're defending right now are laughing at you, and they're at a party surrounded by women, and three big guys come in your cell. That's what you're looking at right now. That's the decision. They're going to be laughing at how stupid you were for lying to them, and you're the one doing time for what they did. That's the conversation that he would give his clients, and I guarantee you there are versions of that all over Southern California with these people that were reluctant to help the police.
So let me ask you this, given what we know so far based on this incredible memorandum, you know, this briefing, do you see this case actually going to trial? Do you see that there will be a robust argument that David, or do you see that his only chance for avoiding death penalty would be a plea?
Okay, so that's a great question. The death penalty is interesting. In Southern California, there's this idea, and some it happens in other states, where they will allege the death penalty with the idea of doing what's called extracting a plea, where they'll allege death, and then they come in and they
leverage. You
know, it's leverage, right? I am of the view that it's not appropriate to do that. And Orange County was very, very solid. My old boss was a guy named Rick King, who is also like a prosecutorial philosopher. And it was, you never do that. You plead what you prove, and then you go into court and you prove what you pled. That was hammered into my head from the outset. And you don't, in Orange County, we never did that. If you have a second degree murder, you pursue it as a second degree murder. You never pursue it as a first or allege a special circumstance to extract a second degree murder plea. If it's a second degree murder, you file it as a second degree murder, you pursue it as a second degree murder, and you argue to the jury that it's a second degree murder. And one of the things, it's critically important, everybody needs to understand, prosecutors have to believe to the bottom of their soul in the efficacy and the truth of everything that they're doing. They're different than other kinds of lawyers. You don't do that. It's not, and I do some civil cases now, Ashley, where you do these mediations and you come in and you see these lawyers, I want $100 million. And that's stupid. On a case that's worth $1 million, you don't like, and you see it all the time. It is anathema to everything that I learned as a prosecutor. I've never once in my career stood up in front of a judge or a jury and said a single word that I did not firmly believe to be true. So if you think it's a voluntary manslaughter, you go in and you say it's a voluntary manslaughter, and I'm not giving you a deal. I think, and I don't know what Nathan Hochman is going to do in his decision, but my dealings with him, that is an ethical guy, and that used to be the philosophy under Jackie Lacey. Again, this guy, Joey Esposito, he used to make the call for Jackie Lacey. I've talked to him about this. His philosophy on that was exactly the same as ours. It's improper to extract a plea like
but
that.
Let's just
so
say,
I don't see it happening. I don't see it happening.
if we have a death penalty for the worst of the worst, these are the details that I think would qualify for the worst of the worst. And so if you're not charging it as a death penalty, I don't really know what would you charge for death penalty. So do you see this one being charged and being prosecuted as a death penalty case?
It's a close one. My guess, having no inside scoop on how this decision's going down, my guess is no. If I'm on the committee on this one, and for the penalty phase, it's divided into two parts. You have the guilt phase, and then you have the penalty phase. The penalty phase, you have a thing called K factor in the state of California. You have the seriousness of the circumstances, which here are, it's 12s on a 10 scale, right? It's as bad as it gets. You have other crimes of violence. He's got zero. You have other felony convictions. Again, you got zero. The age of the defendant, he's a young guy. You have an emotional situation where she is, according to the cloud information, she's going to rat him out. She's going to, you know, so all of those factors go into what does the jury do in weighing the aggravating circumstances, which are really, really bad. But there's a bunch of missing parts, you know, that you see in serial killer cases or certain other kinds of cases versus, you know, the mitigating factors. And that's what a juror's job is. On this one, a young man starting his career, you know, who is emotional, and then he's also really dumb. Honestly, this is one I probably go against it, not because of the horror of what he did, because there's no fate bad enough for him in my mind, but you don't want to go into a penalty phase and lose it because the families really emotionally link themselves to the outcome. For the Rivas family, I would not want them to go through that entire process, just have a jury come in and give them LWOP. I would want to make this quick, nothing about this is going to be quick. This is going to go on for years. I would want to make it clean. I wouldn't want to put them through that if I wasn't sure of the outcome. This one's close enough that I probably wouldn't pursue it. And remember, we have a moratorium on the death penalty in the state of California. He'll never be executed. There's over 700 people on death row already. And he's never going to get executed. So the symbolic value of that, you would deliver it for the family. But on this one, I could see somebody taking pity on him because he's so young and he was desperate and he looked at his whole career blown up. And these are not excuses I'm making up. This guy is just the way juries are. Hell for me. This guy. I'm going to sit there with my bag of popcorn as they roast him. So I'm thinking no death. And they're not coming off LWOP on this. So I think this is going to go to trial. And if they do plead to something, it'll be he'll plead to LWOP. He'll plead to the special circ and then hope that they change the law in the state of California and let him out.
LWOP being life without the possibility of parole for anybody who doesn't know that acronym. It's one of my favorites. I also call it toe tag parole, which means you're not coming out without a tag on your toe.
Yeah, in California, there's all these movements to undo that, which will be a horrible day for justice if they ever do. But anyway, those are my thoughts on this one, Ashley. So I hope you have me on again to keep talking about it.
So appreciate this, and I will be calling you again. And I know I'm like 32 seconds until you got to go. So I appreciate it. Thanks, Matt.
Okay, thank you. Talk soon.
My great thanks to Matt Murphy. Boy, I always love my conversations with him, and I think you do too because I read your comments and you guys really like him because he's smart and he knows what he's talking about. But I will be fascinated to follow along with this case and have Matt jump in every so often as we learn more in the discovery process. I hope it's not gagged. Let's all do like a collective woosa on that. But super appreciative of his insight. Coming up in the following episodes, I do want to tell you that I am going to be doing a deep dive into some of the evidence that a private investigator named Steve Fisher was able to see with his own eyes and actually unearth with his own smarts that he was not able to really talk about up until this all dropped in our laps, all this ugly awfulness, this incredible briefing. So he's going to join me to talk about stuff he laid eyes on, that burn cage. I remember he got inside that house in the Hollywood Hills, and lo and behold, he's looking at the actual burn cage that's sitting there in David's, rental home. So he's going to talk about all the things that he wasn't able to talk about before, and I cannot wait because he's been a really good guest up until now, and I think it's going to get even better because now he's a little bit more free to speak. Also, I encourage you to like, thank you if you do, and subscribe, because I don't want you to miss these episodes. And I'm also continuing my investigation in the Bahamas on the disappearance of Lynette Hooker, where she is, where they might find her, I hope, one day soon. And what is going to happen with Brian Hooker? Because I am unearthing a lot of stuff there as well. It's just that lots of stuff is coming in at once, and I didn't want you to miss these details about the case against David Burke. For now, though, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for watching. Don't forget, like, subscribe, and join our little club as well. Members get exclusive content. They get to ask me personal questions and questions about these cases. And we do have a lot of fun during those Ask Me Anything episodes and meetings. So I encourage you to do so. Also, send me a tip. I have a tip line, dropdeadseriousinfo@gmail.com. Easy, dropdeadseriousinfo@gmail.com. Send me your tips about the David case. Send me your tips about Bahamas or any other case that's on your mind. If you got photos, if you got video, if you got something you think is important, by all means, send it my way. Thanks so much, everyone, again. And remember, truth isn't just serious. It's drop dead serious.